knees, step in and hit. Her teacher kept the instructions simple. Galway told the student to say bounce each time the ball landed in front of her, and to say hit each time the ball hit her racket. Bounce, hit, bounce, hit, bounce, hit. When she followed the advice, the student began to relax. She wasn't preoccupied with form and technique, and she wasn't worrying about outcome. Her eyes were fixed on the target. Her mind was focused on the task. In playing sports, we tend to overanalyze. Go to 10 golf instructors, and you may get 10 different verbal cues on how to take the club head away from the ball, initiate hip turn, transfer your weight, keep the left arm straight, and trigger the downswing. Some well-meaning instructors make the game too complex. The old joke is that if golf instructors taught sex education, it would be the end of civilization as we know it. Part of the brain is always thinking, analyzing, computing, and judging. When I worked with the Cubs, Richie Zisk was the team's bat doctor. His official title was Doctor of Batology. Zisk referred to the overthinking, overanalyzing, critical voice in a batter's head as the chattering monkey. When you're at the plate, or on the tee, or on the tennis court, and you're listening to all this mental commentary, this verbal static, do you think you can perform at your best? Of course not. This should be your goal. Play with your eyes, not your ideas. I see the ball, I hit the ball, Ken Griffey Jr. says. At the plate, he isn't thinking about swing plane or the position of his elbow. Matt Williams doesn't concern himself with the biography or resume of the pitcher he is facing. His eyes are zeroed in on one thing, the baseball. Listen to former pitcher Oral Hershiser. Once my catcher and I determine the pitch, that's all there is. There's nobody standing there then. I don't think about the next game, the next inning, the next hitter, the next play. There's only the next pitch. It's the only job I have. Tom Seaver said when he was on the mound, he blocked everything out. Forget that the second baseman just muffed a double play ball, or that the umpire is missing a lot of calls, or that your wife just charged $700 at Bloomingdale's. Bounce, hit. Focus on the target. Set your mind on the task. In the movie For Love of the Game, Kevin Costner plays an aging major league pitcher at the end of his career. In his final game, while struggling with fatigue and pain, he uses a mental technique to help him focus on the task. It is triggered by a verbal command. Clear the mechanism, he tells himself. Suddenly, he becomes detached. He is no longer in Yankee Stadium. He doesn't hear the crowd. He doesn't see the players around him. And he even blocks out the hitter, menacingly waving his bat. He isn't analyzing the situation. He is inside a cocoon of concentration. Jack Nicklaus calls concentration a fine antidote for anxiety. On the mound, the pitcher is in a world of calm. He is living in his eyes, which are trained on the target. All he can see is the pocket of his catcher's mitt. In his book, Golf My Way, Nicklaus talks about the single-minded imagery he uses before hitting a shot. It's like a color movie, Nicklaus writes. First, I see the ball, where I want it to finish, nice and white, and sitting up high on the bright green grass. Then the scene quickly changes, and I see the ball going there, its path, trajectory, and shape, even its behavior on landing. Then there is sort of a fade-out, and the next scene shows me making the kind of swing that will turn the previous images into reality. It is said the eyes are the mirror to the soul. They also are the mirror to the mind. With great athletes, their eyes aren't searchlights. They aren't even spotlights. They are laser beams. During a game in Seattle, Arizona Cardinals quarterback Jake Plummer took a beating. The Seahawks pass rushers sacked him 7 times. Late in the game, when the young quarterback returned to the huddle, his veteran left tackle, Lomas Brown, gave him a watchful look. "Jake," Brown said, "let me see your eyes."
"Why the eyes?"
"The eyes," Brown said, speaking from experience, "tell it all." Brown could see, in Plummer's eyes, if the quarterback had lost his confidence or given up. He could tell if Jake was still there, mentally, playing in the present. When an athlete's eyes start to wander, so will his mind. Darting eyes are usually not fixed on the task at hand. Yogi was right when he said you can observe a lot just by watching. In working with athletes, I have them view a videotape of themselves performing at their best. The imagery is more instructive than words. They absorb the images and the positive feelings. They begin to lose their analytical mind and come to their senses. Do you play with your eyes? How well do you concentrate on the target? Bodybuilder Arnold Schwarzenegger visualizes a specific muscle's contour when he is working out. "A pump when I see the muscle I want," he said, "is worth 10 with my mind drifting." One exercise you may find helpful is to pick up an object, a tennis ball, a golf ball, a baseball, or a glove. Hold it. Look at it. Study it. Contemplate it. When your thoughts begin to wander, return your full attention to the object. The exercise will improve your ability to focus and help increase awareness of where your mind goes. If your mind starts to wander, so will your performance. Keep your eyes centered on the target and your mind set on the task at hand. Focus on the process and let go of the outcome. The bottom line. The will to win is important, but the will to prepare to win is vital. Joe Paterno. Failing to prepare is preparing to fail. Wayne Gretzky. Sylvie Bernier had a history of caving in during pressure situations, but now she stood on the top step of the platform, beaming. As the French-Canadian springboard diver turned her eyes to her country's flag and sang the national anthem, the only thing that kept her from rising off the medal stand and floating away like a party balloon was the anchoring weight of the gold medal around her neck. The experience was everything Sylvie had hoped it would be. From the moment she arrived at the pool, her day went exactly as she had imagined and rehearsed over and over in her mind. "I knew I was going to dive the 6th of August at 4 o'clock in the afternoon in the finals," Bernier recalled in the video Mind Over Muscle. "I knew where the scoreboard was going to be, on my left. I knew where the coaches were going to be sitting. Everything was in my head. I knew where the crowd was going to be. I could see my dives exactly how I wanted them to be. When I went to the podium, I had seen it before. It was like deja vu." The 20-year-old champion from Quebec won because she came to the biggest event of her life fortified with what every athlete needs: confidence. What do you think is the most important part of the mental game? It's a question I've asked hundreds of managers, coaches, and professional athletes during plane flights and bus rides to stadiums over the past 20 years. The answer is always the same. It's confidence. When you're confident, you can relax, trust your stuff, and perform at your best. Confidence is the bottom line. Where does confidence come from? Great athletes say that confidence is knowing they are prepared physically and mentally. Experience tells them what to do, and confidence allows them to do it. Confidence is the emotional knowing that you are prepared, mind, body, and spirit, for anything. Alan Brunicini is the Vince Lombardi of fire chiefs. The head of the Phoenix Fire Department made an interesting comment about confidence. He told me that confidence is knowing what to do when you don't know what to do. Louis Pasteur never fought a four-alarm blaze under a desert sun or coached a team in the Super Bowl, but the words of the 19th-century scientist apply to firefighters, football players, Olympic divers, and every other performer. Chance, Pasteur said, favors the prepared mind. Or, as golfer Tom Kite said, give luck a chance to happen. Throughout this book, we stress that mental preparation is as important as physical preparation, if not more so. Television broadcaster Ahmad Rashad, a former All-Pro NFL receiver, said, "Some players with a lot of athletic ability just go out and play. Then, after 4 or 5 years, you don't hear about them anymore. The smart guys figure it out, and they play 10, 12 years. They do it mentally more than they do it physically." Confidence is the result of preparation, and preparation begins with forming a mental game plan. The great athletes visualize not only best-case scenarios, but also worst-case scenarios. They don't imagine failing, but they do mentally plan how they will respond in unpleasant and difficult situations. In sports, the ball takes funny or not-so-funny bounces. Oftentimes, games or contests don't go as we had hoped. The prepared athlete has not only a plan A, but also a plan B and a plan C. Reggie Jackson called winning the science of preparation. "And preparation can be defined in 3 words, Jackson said. Leave nothing undone. No detail is too small. When our astronauts trained for the first flight to the moon, they rehearsed for everything going wrong as well as for everything going right. If something out of the ordinary happened, they knew how to respond. They over-prepared so they wouldn't underperform." During his playing days, former NFL quarterback Fran Tarkenton prepared for the upcoming game by seeing himself, in his mind's eye, performing in difficult situations. "I'm trying to visualize every game situation, every defense they're going to throw at me," Tarkenton said. "I tell myself, what will I do on their 5-yard line, and it's 3rd and goal to go, and our short passing game hasn't been going too well, and their line looks like a wall, and we're 6 points behind." The marquee athlete uses his mind to program the body. Listen to Nolan Ryan, the Hall of Fame pitcher, describe his routine. "The night before a game, I lie down, close my eyes, relax my body, and prepare myself for the game. I go through the entire lineup of the other team, one batter at a time. I visualize exactly how I am going to pitch to each hitter, and I see and feel myself throwing exactly the pitches that I want to throw. Before I ever begin to warm up at the ballpark, I've faced all of the opposition's hitters 4 times, and I've gotten my body ready for exactly what it is I want to do." When you're relaxed, you're in a more receptive state for positive affirmations and visualizations. Steve Carlton, the former strikeout artist with the Phillies, had his own pregame routine. Like Ryan, Carlton would stretch out on a training table and close his eyes. "A lot of people think he's sleeping," said Tim McCarver, who was Carlton's catcher. "But what he's thinking about are lanes in the strike zone. He thinks about the outer lane and the inner lane. He doesn't even think about anything over the middle. And by not thinking about it, he gets himself working that way." ESPN announcer Harold Reynolds used imagery when he played second base for the Mariners. "As I'm running my sprints, I'll listen to the lineup and visualize where I want to play this guy. The night before, I'll make mental and physical notes about how they pitched and played me. I'll write down the guy's move, whether he might want to go right after me or nibble with me. I've got to be ready for that." Olympic champion Bart Connor mentally rehearsed his performance. In the book, What Makes Winners Win, Connor said he saw himself as a gymnast doing his routine, feeling the rhythm and the timing. "Then I try to visualize as if I were the person who was standing back and watching me perform," Connor said. "And that's a little different picture. I was always at my best when I saw that picture. It's like once you had visualized it, you see the scene, you see the gym, you see the judges, you see the arena, you see where the equipment is, you see where the chalk tray is. You see everything. So when you actually go to perform, it's like, oh, I've been here before. Then you have such confidence because it's like you've already been through this. Just as you wouldn't go into a baseball game without taking batting practice, don't go into your competition without taking mental practice. Visualize yourself performing. See the action. Feel yourself moving. Hear the sounds. Smell the smells. Make your images as vivid and clear as you can. Confidence comes from the emotional knowing that you are prepared mentally as well as physically. Over-prepare so you don't underperform. Part 4. In the Zone. Trust your stuff. Be decisive. A wrong decision is generally less disastrous than indecision. Bernhard Longer. If there is any doubt in your mind, how can your muscles know what they are expected to do? Harvey Penick. On the day of the final round of the 2000 Masters Tournament, Vijay Singh received a nice surprise, the kind of surprise that touches a father's heart, the kind that brings a smile. Singh's 9-year-old son, Kaas, had pinned a note to his dad's golf bag. The message read, "Papa, trust your swing." Not wanting to disappoint the boy who trusted in his father, the leader did as requested. Playing steadily and confidently from the first hole to the last, the man from Fiji, whose first name means victory, won the Masters by 3 shots. Afterward, he appeared with Kaas at the champions' press conference, wearing the green jacket and a triumphant smile. "That's what I tried to do," Singh said, reflecting on his round. He looked at his son. "Trust my swing." Successful athletes trust their talents. They are committed to every swing, every stroke, every shot, and every pitch. When asked for golfing tips, I tell friends that the best advice I can give is that it's better to be decisive than right. The late Harvey Penick, one of the game's most revered instructors, said, "If you are indecisive, if you have doubts, if there is a lack of commitment in your mind, how is your body going to know what to do?" We all have seen what can happen to the most talented athletes. Under pressure, they sometimes become tentative and indecisive. They don't trust their stuff. One such scene played out during a sudden-death playoff at the Masters in 1990. It was almost a gimme. Only 2 feet stood between Scott Hoke's ball and victory. He lined up the winning putt from one direction. He walked behind the hole and gave it a second look. Hoke came back, knelt behind his ball, and studied the line a while longer. Then he took another look. It was 24 inches, tops, almost straight in, but Hoke looked like pool shark Minnesota Fats circling a green felted billiard table, chalking his cue, and reading every angle before making a 4-bank trick shot. It was growing late. Instead of unconsciously speeding up, as some athletes do under stress, Hoke slowed down. Chichi Rodriguez said, "Take less time to read the scorecard and more time to read the hole." Good advice, but Hoke read the hole as if it were War and Peace. Finally, the golfer stepped up to his ball, settled into his stance. Eyes flicked anxiously from ball to hole, hole to ball, back and forth. Watching on TV, Ben Crenshaw, conscious of the passing time Hoke had spent, 55 seconds and counting, was on the edge of a scream. "Geez," Ben said, "hit it." At last, Hoke drew back the putter blade. There was more prayer than conviction in his stroke. Click. The ball slid 3 feet past the hole. Crenshaw flinched and shook his head. "Like my dad says," Ben said in disbelief, "good God almighty." Hoke went on to lose to Nick Faldo, who birdied the second playoff hole. Doubts cause intellectual confusion. Doubts can be paralyzing. It is said that a person who doubts himself is like a man who would enlist in the ranks of his enemies and bear arms against himself. Confidence and trust are essential in every sport. Hall of Fame pitcher Sandy Koufax of the Dodgers said it is better to throw a poor pitch wholeheartedly than to throw the so-called right pitch with a feeling of doubt. You've got to feel sure you're doing the right thing, sure that you want to throw the pitch that you're going to throw. Today's Dodgers ace, Kevin Brown, says that if you make a bad pitch aggressively, you have a much better chance of getting away with it. The habits of success are forged in practice. In practice, you learn the art of concentration. You can be out there in the middle of a tough match pleading to yourself, "Concentrate, concentrate," and it won't happen for you, said Martina Navratilova, the former tennis star. Concentration is born on the practice court. You must mentally treat your practice sessions as matches, concentrating on every ball you hit. In practice, you learn to train your brain as well as your body. Sam Snead said practice time is when you put your brain into your muscles. The conscious practice of routines leads to the unconscious habits of success. A routine is something you do regularly that you control and has a purpose. Before Nomar Garcia-Parra steps into the batter's box, he begins a series of fidgety gestures, repeatedly tugging on his batting gloves. Taking his stance, he taps one toe and then the other against the dirt. They are the same quirky habits he performs in practice. Every hitter has his own routine. Routines are comforting mechanisms, triggering mechanisms. They differ, however, from rituals based upon superstition, like Wade Boggs' habit of eating chicken at 3 p.m. before every night game. In golf, a pre-shot routine begins with the player standing behind the ball, looking at the target. In a thinking mode, it's time to analyze and develop strategy. Ask yourself questions. Where is the pin? What direction is the wind blowing? It's the time to mentally shape the shot, as Jack Nicklaus described. Once you have decided how you are going to play the shot and you step up to the ball, it's time to get your head out of the way so your body can perform. Turn off the analytical mind. Switch from the thinking mode to the trusting mode. You can't be thinking and swinging at the same time. Ask yourself this. Are you better than your stuff? No. So just trust it. You must be 100% committed to each action. If there are doubts in your mind, your muscles won't know what to do. Let your routines switch you from the thinking mode to the trusting mode. White moments. Each time I step on the basketball court, I never know what will happen. I live for the moment. I play for the moment. Michael Jordan. When I'm in my groove, there is no thinking. Everything just happens. Ozzie Smith. Ben Crenshaw was as surprised as anyone when he broke par in the opening round of the Masters in 1995. A day earlier, he had been in Austin, Texas, attending the funeral of Harvey Penick, his 90-year-old teacher and lifelong friend. Harvey gave Crenshaw his first golf club when Ben was 6. Over the years, Harvey was always there, offering his pupil encouragement and simple teachings that expressed a philosophy that went deeper than mechanical advice. After burying his dear friend, Crenshaw flew to Augusta National. When he arrived, he felt tired, hollow, washed out. He was emotionally spent. "I don't know what to expect," Crenshaw said before teeing off. 4 days later, what he never imagined would happen, did. At age 43, 11 years after his last win at the Masters, Ben won again. When the final putt fell, Crenshaw bent over and hid his face in his hands and wept. "I still reflect on it so much," Crenshaw said 5 years later. "So many unexplained things happened that week. I hadn't played worth a darn in a good while, but I gained a lot of confidence that first day, and it kept going. I was very relaxed, but determined, too. In many respects, I felt like I was a kid again. I played by instinct the whole week. I was as calm as I've ever been. Many people who play sports long enough or work at their craft hard enough experience those magical moments where their training and trust in themselves come together in perfect harmony. Their performance flows smoothly, effortlessly, and almost unconsciously. This heightened level of performance, Michael Jordan described it as the reward for years of hard work and preparation, is unexplainable. Sometimes these special moments seem to happen as if by grace. Perhaps you have experienced a competition when everything falls into place, like tumblers in a wall safe. You feel like pinching yourself to verify you're not dreaming. At times you want to break out laughing while telling yourself, "This is unreal. I'm not this good." But at that moment in place, you are. All great athletes know the feeling. They use different words to describe it. They're on autopilot. They're tuned in total control, in the groove, locked. Japanese baseball players have their own word for it, mushin. Loosely translated, it means no mind. Tennis star Arthur Ashe called it playing in the zone. "The zone is the essence of the athletic experience," said former NFL player Dave Megacy. "And those moments of going beyond yourself are the underlying allure of sports." The moments are rare and illuminating. Yuri Vlasov, the former world champion Russian weightlifter, wrote verse when he was in training. His illustrative description of the zone experience reflects the soul of a poet. "At the peak of tremendous and victorious effort," Vlasov said, "while the blood is pounding in your head, all suddenly becomes quiet within you. Everything seems clearer and whiter than before, as if great spotlights had been turned on. At that moment, you have the conviction that you contain all the power in the world, that you are capable of everything, that you have wings. There is no more precious moment in life than this, the white moment, and you will work very hard for years just to taste it again." Athletes in every sport occasionally experience being in the zone. Former NBA player Byron Scott said, "All you can hear is this little voice inside you telling you shoot every time you touch the ball, because you know it's going in." As a Phoenix Sun, Charles Barkley scored 56 points in a playoff game against the Golden State Warriors. In the first quarter, he made 11 field goals in a row, layups, jump shots, three-pointers from all over the court. No misses. As one shot fell, then another, his teammates along the bench were on their feet, grinning and shaking their heads. Joe Klein made a circle with his arms, as if to indicate the rim was the size of a hula hoop. After Barkley drilled in a flat trajectory jumper over a defender, the Suns star turned to the Warriors' cheerleaders, huddled under one basket. His grin said, "You ain't stopping me, not tonight." The late Jim Catfish Hunter accomplished the ultimate as a pitcher with the Oakland A's. "I wasn't worried about a perfect game going into the ninth," he recalled. "It was like a dream. I was going on like I was in a daze. I never thought about it the whole time. If I'd thought about it, I wouldn't have thrown a perfect game. I know I wouldn't." When you're in the zone, you have switched from a training mode to a trusting mode. You are not fighting yourself. You are not afraid of anything. You are living in the moment, in a special place in time. As a certified hypnotist, I see similarities between people who are in a trance and those in a performance zone. At age 13, Tiger Woods worked with a sports psychologist who taught him how to use hypnosis to block out his conscious mind and to strengthen his resolve and focus. Skills in hypnosis helped the young golfer go to such deep levels of concentration that he couldn't remember making certain shots. Tiger told the New York Times Magazine, You ever go up to a tee and say, "Don't hit it left, don't hit it right"? That's your conscious mind. My body knows how to play golf. I've trained it to do that. It's just a matter of keeping my conscious mind out of it. Athletes who are playing in the zone experience time distortion. Everything seems to slow down. Describing a peak performance, NBA star Reggie Miller said, "It all seemed to happen in slow motion." In Tai Chi, they call it falling through a hole. The awareness of the passage of time completely stops. Others experience size and space distortion. The ball looked like a grapefruit, or the basketball rim was a hula hoop. Athletes in the zone see everything with clarity. They are relaxed. They perform with a quiet mind, with no indecision and no doubts. They can almost anticipate what is going to happen. They are totally absorbed. Golfer Tony Jacklin likened the zone to being in a cocoon. Dave Winfield said, "I'm in my world." Payne Stewart said, "When it happens, all you see is the ball and the hole." Have you experienced white moments? Can you recall a time when you weren't concerned about the opponent or the outcome and were simply living in the moment and performing at your best? There is no better feeling in sports. The harder you try to get into the zone, the further away you get. The zone is the reward for all your hard work and preparation. Just go with the flow and enjoy the moment. Paralysis by analysis. Slumps are like a soft bed, easy to get into and hard to get out of. Johnny Bench. A full mind is an empty bat. Branch Rickey. Several years ago, the Cubs selected Rick Wilkins in the first round of the draft. The young catcher was labeled a can't-miss prospect. To use a sports cliche, his future was all ahead of him, which is where the future should be. While playing for Peoria in the Class A Midwest League, Wilkins began struggling at the plate. "Forget hitting a baseball. I couldn't hit the broad side of a barn with an oar," the youngster said, voicing his growing frustration after a loss. "The next day, I went to Peoria, Illinois, at the Cubs' request, to work with a farm club. That afternoon, I gave an inspired talk to the Chiefs team about the mental aspects of performance. The players and coaches really got into it." That night, Wilkins looked like a different player. The kid belted a first-inning home run. In the third inning, he doubled. Later, he added a sacrifice fly. "What a difference a day makes," Wilkins said, beaming after the game. "I just saw the ball well and let the bat go." Next morning, the headline in the local newspaper read something like, "Cubs shrink helps phenom out of slump." I felt gratified and proud until I spoke with Wilkins the next day. He told me he had missed my talk because of a dental appointment. Sports is a roller coaster. It's a series of performance peaks and valleys, ups and downs, twists and turns. If an athlete's best day is a zone experience, then the worst day is one in which he or she is muddled in a slump, a natural cycle in sports. While we associate the word slump with baseball, athletes in all sports experience times when they feel as if they can't do anything right. The University of Tennessee football team once beat Alabama 24-0. It was the first time an Alabama team coached by Bear Bryant had failed to score in 115 games. The Crimson Tide attempted 51 passes, but the Volunteers picked off 8 of them. In the huddle, an Alabama wide receiver, who hadn't lost his sense of humor, suggested to his quarterback that he try throwing one to a Tennessee linebacker, and I'll see if I can intercept it. Golfer Ian Baker Finch won the 1991 British Open and then went into an extended slump. His game just left him without a note of goodbye. At times, other athletes have felt as helpless and perplexed as the Major League rookie who stopped hitting and went to a veteran teammate for advice. The old pro suggested that the youngster switch to a 29-ounce bat.
"Will it help?" the kid asked hopefully.
"No," the veteran said, "but it'll be lighter carrying back to the dugout." The old joke is that there are many theories on conquering slumps. Unfortunately, not one of them works. Some athletes deal with slumps by denying their existence. After he broke a 0-for-20 drought, Dave Henderson claimed, "I wasn't in a slump. I just wasn't getting any hits." Yogi Berra didn't blame himself when he wasn't hitting. He blamed his bat. If his woes continued, he changed lumber. "I know it sounds silly," Berra said, "but it keeps me from getting down in the dumps. It keeps my confidence up." Billy Williams, a hitting instructor with the Cubs, likened a slump to a traveling illness. A slump starts in your head and winds up in your stomach. You know that eventually it will happen, and you begin to worry about it. Then you know you're in one, and it makes you sick. Sometimes slumps can be traced to physical problems or mechanical glitches. But oftentimes, the problem is all in the mind. Athletes who begin to struggle start overanalyzing. They hear that monkey Richie Zisk talked about, chattering in their head. They start thinking too much. In a Peanuts cartoon, Snoopy commends Woodstock on making a perfect landing on the roof of his doghouse. Then he begins quizzing the tiny yellow bird about aerodynamics. "Now, when you take off again, do you push with your feet, or do you flap your wings first? Do you flap your wings and sort of lean into it, or do you..." In the next panel, Woodstock has disappeared, having dropped straight to the ground with a clunk after takeoff. Snoopy put the lesson learned into words. If you think about it, you can't do it. A former ball player didn't mean to sound funny when he said of a slump he was in, "I've been doing my best not to think about it, but by trying so hard not to think about it, I can't stop thinking about it." Overthinking often leads to overtrying. When you're in a slump, you start going up to the plate trying to hit a home run, Major League outfielder Corey Snyder said. You start pressing instead of just letting things happen. You let all the negatives come floating through your mind. Not long ago, an NBA player came to me during a low point in his career. Nagging injuries had affected his long-range shooting. His field goal percentage dropped dramatically. Media scrutiny added to the pressure and frustration he felt. His answer for combating his slump had been to work longer and harder in practice. I urged him to relax, rest his body, and get his mind off the game for a couple of days. Get away from basketball. Take his wife and children on a picnic. In an attempt to regain his form, he was digging himself deeper into a hole and needed to put the shovel down. Years ago, when I was a director at St. Luke's Medical Center in Phoenix, I met Carl Kiel, who was then head of player development with the Oakland A's. Kiel had spent a lifetime in the game as a player, scout, coach, and manager. He shared with me his views about the mental game of baseball, which became the title for a book he co-authored. Kiel once asked a major leaguer what he would be concentrating on in the game that night. The player was hitting an anemic 226 at the time. "I want to get a couple of hits and drive in a couple of runs," the player said. Kiel reminded him that a hitter doesn't have control over whether he gets hits or drives in runs. Carl is right. Instead of being outcome-oriented, a hitter should concentrate on what he can control. Focus on having quality at-bats. What is a quality at-bat? It means relaxing, seeing the ball well, and being patient. The difference between a 250 hitter and a 300 hitter in the major leagues is only one hit a week. The key to overcoming a slump is finding a difference that will make a difference. Usually this means doing less rather than more. Sports is filled with ups and downs. Remember, the first rule of holes is to stop digging. Go back to basics and keep things simple. Paradoxes of performances. To succeed in baseball, as in life, you must make adjustments.
Ken Griffey Sr.
Sometimes you have to get worse before you get better.
Tom Watson.
Why are boxing rings square?
Why is the foul pole fair?
These questions illustrate the contradictory and paradoxical nature of sports. A paradox is defined as a seemingly contradictory statement that may nonetheless be true. After Steve McKinney broke the world downhill ski record, he said, "I discovered the middle path of stillness within speed, calmness within fear, and I held it longer and quieter than ever before." Whenever I think about paradoxes, I recall Muhammad Ali's heavyweight title fight against George Foreman in Zaire, Africa. Who would have thought that a boxer could win by inviting his opponent to hit him? The more times, the better. But that's what Ali did. For 7 rounds, Ali leaned against the ropes and allowed, encouraged, his powerful young opponent to flail away with a barrage of body punches. The rope-a-dope strategy worked. In the 8th round, with Foreman arm-weary and exhausted, Ali abandoned his defensive posture and sent George spinning to the canvas with a left-right combination. Ali's strategy seems as contradictory as the idea of going over a high jump bar upside down. Dick Fosbury turned his back to the bar before jumping over it at the Olympics in Mexico City. The American won the gold medal, and his innovative new technique, which became known as the Fosbury flop, has been used by almost every high jumper since. Sports is always changing. The forward pass changed football forever. The jump shot changed basketball. Metal woods, an oxymoron, have changed golf. And oversized rackets have changed tennis. Just as games change, athletes must be willing to make changes and adjustments. This isn't always easy. Try this. Fold your arms in front of you. Now unfold them. And fold them again, this time the other way. It feels awkward, doesn't it? It doesn't feel natural. As we talked about earlier, by making needed adjustments in your game, your performance may suffer temporarily. You have to be willing to get worse before you can get better, which is one of the paradoxes of sports we will discuss. Sports is a game of balances. An example I use is that people who are sick take medicine to get well. But too much medicine can be poisonous, even fatal. In school, kids are taught that if they don't succeed, then try again. I tell athletes, yes, try again. Don't give up, but maybe try something different. Perhaps do the opposite, a 180-degree turn. Many coaches are rigid and inflexible in their thinking. Everything is black or white. It isn't. Sports can be both black and white, like the Oriental yin-yang symbol. I try to teach any performer to play in the gray and to understand and accept the paradoxical nature of sports. Let's examine 10 paradoxes. Less can be more. Sometimes the highest form of action is inaction. Athletes require rest and recovery time. Without it, they become stale, burned out, and more susceptible to injuries. In this book, we quote Vince Lombardi saying, "The harder you work, the harder it is to surrender." So how can not working as hard as possible be an advantage? 1 year, the Arizona Cardinals had lost 3 games in a row. The coaching staff's response was to practice more. You see that with many coaches. They believe that if the team isn't winning, the players aren't working hard enough. So the NFL team worked out on Thanksgiving Day. The players didn't want to be there. Their minds were on family and turkey dinner. The team went through a half-hearted practice, and its star defensive back, Tim McDonald, blew out his knee and missed the remainder of the season. The harder you try to get into the zone, the further away you get. We talked about this in the White Moments section. Train hard. But then let the performance flow naturally. Don't try to make something happen. Just trust your stuff and let it happen. Trying easier can be harder. Many athletes put too much muscle into their performance in an attempt to create power. Oftentimes, over-muscling is self-defeating. Remember the golfer's prayer, "God, grant me the strength to swing easier." Over-control gets you out of control. Or you can gain control by giving up control. When pitchers become too cautious and controlling with their pitches, they often start aiming and steering the ball with unhappy results. Performance improves when they surrender to the process. You often see this on the golf course, too. A weekend player having a miserable round gives up hope. That's when he suddenly sinks the 40-foot putt or hits his longest and straightest drive of the day. Why? He is no longer trying to control his swing. Slowing down can make you faster. Jay Novacek learned this paradoxical truth while training with his college track team. Pace instead of race. Be quick, but never hurry. I once worked with a golfer trying to qualify for the U.S. Open. Instead of arriving in plenty of time before his morning round, he showed up later than planned. He started rushing, and as a result, he didn't play his best. Shortcuts often take you the wrong way. Fear of failure makes failure more likely. Fear creates tension and affects coordination and rhythm. The chances of success are diminished. Oftentimes, a team that puts together a winning streak becomes preoccupied with not losing. Once the streak ends and the house of cards falls, players breathe a sigh of relief. Now, they tell themselves and each other, we can start over and concentrate on winning one game at a time. Playing it safe can be dangerous. Or the greatest risk sometimes is not to take a risk. Figure skater Michelle Kwan played it safe in her final performance at the 1998 Winter Olympics. Tara Lipinski, the underdog, held nothing back and skated a more difficult routine and then won the gold medal. Kwan later won the world championship by going out and letting her performance flow. By playing it safe, athletes are reluctant to make the adjustments necessary to move up to the next level of competition. A pitcher with a funky curveball will strike out the side in Class A, but that same pitch will be lunch meat in the big leagues. Improvement requires letting go of old ways. A step backward is a step forward. Sometimes you have to get worse to become better. Tiger Woods stepped back when he retooled his swing. He and his coach, Butch Harmon, believed that in the long run, Tiger would become a more consistent and better player, which he has. The probability of getting the outcome you want increases when you let go of the need to get it. The more you want to achieve a goal, the more expectations you place upon yourself. Greg Norman wants to win the Masters more than any other tournament. He may want to win too badly, which some theorize is the biggest reason why he hasn't, despite coming very close. Give yourself permission to win, but then let go of the idea of winning and focus on execution and the process. While you must be present to win, you also have to be absent to win. Athletes who experience those white moments lose their conscious mind. They are wrapped in a cocoon. They are living in the moment. Understand the paradoxical nature of sports. Learn to play in the gray. Sometimes you have to get worse before you get better. Choice, not chance. Consistency is what counts. You have to do things over and over again. Hank Aaron. The greatest and toughest art in golf is playing badly well. All the greats have been masters at it. Jack Nicklaus. Invariably, the question will come after I've lipped out three putts in a row or as I'm walking off the green, shaking my head with my blood pressure pushing the red line after making a double bogey. A member of our group will turn to me and casually ask, "So, Gary, what do you do for a living?" In those self-conscious moments, I hate admitting that I'm a professional sports psychology consultant. I know what he must be thinking. This guy gets paid to help people with their game? If I'm playing poorly and the question comes, I'll paste on a smile and say, "When you counsel yourself, you have a fool for a client." What fascinates and frustrates me as a golfer is the unpredictability of performance. One day I can shoot 75, which is a good round for me. The next day, playing on the same course and using the same clubs, I may shoot 85. Which player will I be today, Jekyll or Hyde? When he plays badly, Bob, a golfing buddy, laughingly tells me, "My evil twin showed up today." Sports psychology is especially prescribed for two kinds of athletes. Some perform well in practice, but break down in competition because they become self-conscious or over-anxious. Others possess worlds of talent, but can't perform consistently. Consistency separates good athletes from great ones. The best athletes win consistently because they think, act, and practice consistently. Consistency is a defining quality. "Whatever your job, consistency is the hallmark," said Joe Torre, manager of the world champion New York Yankees. It's much more important than doing something spectacular just once. Do your job consistently, and you will be considered good. What made Chris Evert a champion? "My father's coaching, training, and persistent encouragement paved the way," said the former tennis great. "But it was something more. I was consistent over a long period of time because I never looked back, never dwelled on my defeats. I always looked ahead." The greatest athletes are those who can perform at a high level day in and day out, even when they don't feel well or are off their game. As Jack Nicklaus said, "It is an art to play badly well." Closing pitcher Dennis Eckersley didn't always have his good stuff. On those days, he performed a little mental trick. "You fake it," Eckersley said. "You do. You can't let on that you're not throwing well. There's a body language. I really believe it. You've still got to act like you're the man. You can't fake a good fastball. I'm not saying that, but you have to give the impression that your stuff is on time." It's like the television antiperspirant commercial. Never let them see you sweat. Albert Bell says he can sense if a pitcher is confident or feeling a little shaky by the way he carries himself. We reveal much of our thoughts and emotions through body language. In a Peanuts cartoon, Charlie Brown is standing with his head bowed, looking at his shoes. "This is my depressed stance," he tells Lucy. In the next panel, he draws his shoulders back, chin up. "The worst thing you can do is straighten up and hold your head high, because then you'll start to feel better." In the last panel, Charlie Brown assumes his woe is me pose and says, "If you're going to get any joy out of being depressed, you've got to stand like this." Joe DiMaggio said, "You ought to run the hardest when you feel the worst. Never let the other guy know you're down." Chris Evert boiled inside when she played. If her confidence was shaky or she was losing her composure, she worked very hard not to show it. If you give in to your emotions after one loss, you're liable to have three or four in a row. Every athlete has bad days. The trick, Arnold Palmer said, is to stay serene inside even when things are going badly outside. Sam Snead believes that to achieve consistency, a golfer must put a distance between himself and what happens on the course. It's not indifference, it's detachment. Jim Colbert echoes Snead's advice. "My reaction to anything that happens on the golf course is no reaction," Colbert says. "There are no birdies or bogeys, no eagles or double bogeys. There are only numbers. If you can learn that,